From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Geography can be mischievous. Consider the oil and gas producing giants Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the Gulf Emirates, all in one tight zone around the Persian Gulf, and just one pinched waterway out, a skinny, elbow-shaped channel to the rest of the world, the Strait of Hormuz. It's the critical spigot and a heck of a choke point right now in a big global chess game over power, oil, and nukes. Iran has threatened to shut it down. Could it? Would it? This hour on Point, nukes, oil, navies, and the Strait of Hormuz. You can join the conversation. Is this threat for real? Have you sailed the Strait of Hormuz? Could we keep it open? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. This hour, we're going to really study the Strait of Hormuz, the lay of the land and sea, the military balance of power there, the tanker traffic, and the global game of brinkmanship around it unfolding as we speak. On CBS Face the Nation yesterday, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta said that Iran developing a nuclear weapon would be a red line for the United States. But there's another red line, he says, and it's all about the Straits of Hormuz.
We've made very clear that the United States will not tolerate the blocking of the Straits of Hormuz. That's another red line for us, and that we will respond to that.
Could they do it? Would they do it? What would happen? General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was also on Face the Nation alongside Panetta. He talked about Iran's military ability to close the Hormuz choke point and the U.S. military's ability to counter such a move.
They've invested in capabilities that could, in fact, for a period of time, block the Straits of Hormuz. We've invested in capabilities to ensure that if that happens, we can defeat that. And so the simple answer is, yes, they can block it. Of course, that is as well a we've described that as an intolerable act. And it's not just intolerable for us. It's intolerable to the world. But we would take action and reopen the Straits.
We're going to focus very tightly first today on the Strait of Hormuz and then pull back and look at the whole big picture. Joining me first from Monterey, California, is Timothy Dury, U.S. Navy captain who retired in 2009 after 28 years in naval intelligence, now a lecturer at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. Timothy Dury, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So would you just describe this strait for us for a minute to help us have a picture here? I know it's not very wide, and even within that narrowness, there's just sort of a 2 mile wide in lane and a 2 mile wide out lane. What does this look like from, let's say, a naval perspective? Vital choke point, all this oil coming through, a fifth of the world's oil there. What's it look like if you're trying to think about either closing it or defending it or opening it?
Well, I've transited the strait 4 times on the aircraft carrier USS George Washington. Mm-hmm. And if you think of the Arabian Peninsula as sort of a reverse J fishhook, the tip of that fishhook is where the strait is located. And as you proceed from the Indian Ocean going north to the Gulf of Oman, you'll have Oman and part of the United Arab Emirates to your left, mm-hmm. and the Iranian coastline to your right. Now, as you proceed northwest, it becomes increasingly narrow until you get into a sort of a inverted U, mm-hmm. which is the Iranian coastline. So you're proceeding northwest, and then you have to make a very, very tight turn to the left, almost a 90-degree turn. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned before, there's inbound traffic. It's a 2 mile wide lane. There's outbound traffic, a 2 mile wide lane with a 2 mile separation between the two.
Okay.
It's really very, very restricted waters for navigation. And it lasts almost, I'd say, 100 to 200 miles, whereas before you're in the open water again in the Persian Gulf.
Wow.
There's a number of small islands, too, mm-hmm. That are occupied by the Iranians.
There was a long time when American aircraft carriers did not even go through the Strait of Hormuz because it just didn't look like aircraft carrier territory. So little room to maneuver.
Correct. And that had a lot to do with the Iran hostage crisis, where we deployed aircraft carriers off of Iran. What happened was, I think it was the first Gulf War, where the need to have aircraft carriers closer to Kuwait and Iraq forced us to sort of enter the Gulf. And then we took the risk to enter in there. But these are very constrained waters for flight operations, and it's not the ideal situation for the United States Navy capabilities.
Four times you've been through there as a Navy guy. You know, what were you thinking as you looked at the Strait of Hormuz and the constricted space there?
Well, you know, you're very much on your toes, and the Iranians have all the advantages of geography, space, time, and so you're very much on your toes trying to see what they're up to. And I think this would probably be even more so now, given that the exercises they've conducted and some of the statements they've made.
There's so many stories swirling around this. I mean, in very recent days, I mean, just today we have news that Iran is condemning to death this Iranian-American they're accusing of spying there. Over the weekend or before, though, there was this more hopeful story of the U.S. Navy helping rescue Iranian sailors from Somali pirates, sending them on their way back to Iran. That looked great. There was some thanks from Iran for that, but also some sneering that it was just sort of a Hollywood operation. Still looked pretty good. But before that, in the last 10 days or so, we've had very tough exchanges. President Obama on New Year's Day signing this law that is really going to squeeze down on Iran's oil exports. Iran responding by saying that, you know, don't tread on us or we will close the Strait of Hormuz. What do you make of all this, Timothy Dury? If you're in the U.S. Navy or if you're an oil importer, exporter, do you have to take this seriously?
Oh, I would definitely take it seriously. We've been fortunate up to this time that a lot of the Iranian exercises have occurred when U.S. Navy ships were not in the vicinity or ships of our allies. The dangerous part would be if they started to conduct sort of mock attacks when we're actually transiting the straits, because it's very difficult for a Navy captain to understand if it's just a mock attack or it's an actual attack. So it could become increasingly dangerous if that were to happen.
What capacity does Iran have? If you could describe the sort of layers of threat here, what do they look like?
They have quite a few capabilities specifically designed for this type of littoral warfare. They've invested heavily over the last two or three decades. They use a number of fast patrol craft, some of them armed with guns, rockets, and even guided missiles. They're not very large, but they assemble in numbers, and they do something called swarming tactics. They have a number of mines, and these are not just the chemical horn mines we see in World War II movies. Mm-hmm. They have very, very sophisticated mines that they've acquired from around the world, and they've invested heavily on that too. They have a number of anti-ship cruise missiles, including some that they've produced domestically, and they're used on land platforms, trucks, whatever, and also on some of their patrol craft. They have torpedoes. They've built mini submarines. I believe they have 17 of the new shallow draft Gadir submarines. And I think you also have to realize, too, that they have medium-range ballistic missiles, and they could go after targets within throughout the region because of the range of these ballistic missiles.
Now, we'll talk in this hour about whether or not it could ever actually make sense for them to do this, because of course they have their own oil that goes through here, and the implications of shutting it down could lead to all kinds of further situations. But what about, we heard General Dempsey saying yesterday on Face the Nation, yes, they could close them, but then we could open them. Well, what would opening them entail if they brought some or all of these assets that you just described to bear on the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, I was glad to see General Dempsey actually say that, because some people have refused to believe that they could close it. And I think he was right on, and by showing that the capabilities that they've acquired over especially the last two decades gives them that capability. But I think it would be a major military operation to counter these threats. Again, it's a layered defense, and you would have to go after all the parts I just described mm-hmm. earlier. And that you're talking about a major air campaign over days, weeks, just to neutralize these threats. And,
but even an air campaign isn't going to neutralize mines, for example. Are we set to clear the Strait of Hormuz of sophisticated mines?
Well, mine countermeasures, and it's not just the U.S., our allies, especially our mm-hmm. NATO allies and even Japan, have a pretty good mine clearing capability. But it's not an easy thing to do. And I don't think we've done opposed mine countermeasures, it's called MCM, mm-hmm. probably since the Korean War. So this would not be easy, and it would involve a pretty serious campaign to neutralize this threat.
A fifth of the world's oil flows through the Strait of Hormuz. People don't like to think of anything beyond a couple of days, but it sounds to me that you're describing that it would take more than a couple of days to clean up, and even if we had the assets around to mount the very major effort you're describing.
Well, there's many variables in play, and I don't have access to this information, but again, resources in the theater, how the actual conflict would unfold would have a lot to do with it too. But they do have substantial capabilities, and it would take some time to actually eliminate them.
We've got a comment here from a listener online says, hey, not that he approves, but the U.S. would obliterate the entire Iranian coastline and navy in a matter of days if Iran acted on their bluster. Is that obvious to you?
Well, I think it'd be a lot harder than that. I think there'd be surprises on both sides. And, again, the Iranians have developed the capabilities, exercised these quite a bit. And again, I really applaud General Dempsey for pointing out that it's not going to be this easy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Iran, nukes, sanctions, and threats, and how they all come together in the Strait of Hormuz choke point, potentially, for a fifth of the world's oil. Timothy Dury joins us from Monterey, California, lecturer at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, been through the Straits four times and all over this issue. With us right now from Houston is Amy Myers Jaffe, director of the Energy Forum at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy, all kinds of Persian Gulf oil experience under her belt. Amy Myers Jaffe, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
How recently have you been there? What are you thinking about all this back and forth we're seeing between the U.S. and Iran and others now over the Strait?
Well, I was just out to the Gulf in November, December.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say on the Arab side of the Gulf, there's quite a bit of concern about Iran, not only so much about the Straits, because I think there's some confidence given the experience of the Iraq-Iran war where the United States helped escort tankers through and we had minesweepers. There's some confidence that the U.S. military could manage the Strait issue rather well. But I think there's also a lot of concern about Iran fomenting unrest in places like Saudi Arabia's eastern province where the oil gets produced, which is a dominantly Shia population. A lot of concern about the long-term fate of Bahrain and what that will mean for the region. So Iran has poses a multifaceted threat that's not just simply in its most recent manifestation of its declarations about the Strait.
Look at this in energy terms for just a second, Amy. And of course, there are many countries around the world that produce oil and gas. But the Strait of Hormuz, how big a deal in energy terms? If it's threatened, I mean, shut down, we'll talk about that. But just if there's the sense of a real threat, how does that move oil, movement? How does it move oil prices?
Well, as the threat has continued to escalate, oil prices have gone up. We're up a few dollars now. People are back from the holidays. So really the step is going to be, what's the escalation effect? How masterful does the U.S. military appear to be? Any thought that it might take the U.S. military more than a day or two, I think, which is sort of the general thinking in the market, to keep it reopened, is definitely going to have sort of a speculative effect, raising the price of oil. And, for your listeners to think through, how important is this nuclear question? Imagine if we were playing out exactly the same set of circumstances, but the Iranians had a nuclear warhead on a submarine or on missiles.
Mm-hmm.
You could understand how much more dangerous the calculation would be and how to counter their threat. And then you can also look at how much higher the oil market reaction might be if they had a nuclear weapon. But one always has to step back and think about, what do the Iranians gain? So right now, by diverting attention from the fact that they're about to have parliamentary elections and the public is very dissatisfied with the fact that the reform movement leaders are still under house arrest or in jail. There was predictions that there would be riots in Iran. So you can kind of understand why this government would have an interest in challenging the United States and the international community at this time to divert attention away from its internal problems.
They can say, look, we've got the American boogeyman. There is all kinds of reports of Iranians really fearing war. Americans not so focused on it with everything else going on here. But this is an old back and forth. But, Amy, the pressure being put on Iran by the latest legislation signed by President Obama is real. I mean, we see Europeans, the U.S. already cutting back on Iranian oil. Europeans, I should say, looking at cutting back, Asia cutting back. This is really putting pressure on the Iranian economy now.
Well, the Iranian economy has been under incredible pressure. This central bank move, it sounds like a lot, but I'm not 100% sure how much impact it actually has on oil sales, because you have countries like China and other places that have been willing to barter with the Iranians. In other words, they're extending them credit in different ways, you can trade goods for oil. So if somebody wants to buy discounted Iranian oil, it's going to be pretty hard for the administration and the European community to implement that without actually putting some kind of a blockade, our own blockade. I think that there's always a way to do a commercial transaction, even without a bank and even without money, if you intend earnestly to do it. And so really, the administration's going to have to do a lot of diplomacy. And it's hard for me to see, though I've discussed it with members of the Chinese foreign ministry, mm-hmm. how it's in their interest to be dependent on oil from Iran, given how unstable internally the country is, given their conflict with the international community. It seems like a bad bet. But the Chinese say they feel very vulnerable on their oil supply and they cannot afford to alienate bilateral relations.
But we've got, though, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner headed out to Beijing and Tokyo next week. And a big part of what he's looking to do there is to seek their cooperation in tightening sanctions on Iran. Amy Myers, Jeffy, please stand by in Houston. Timothy Dury in Monterey. We've got a lot of callers here. Chris in Watertown, New York. Chris, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
About 15 years ago, I actually studied just up the hill from the Naval Postgraduate School at the DLI, the Defense Language Institute.
Okay.
And further on in our training, we actually studied the Strait of Hormuz is one of the biggest training scenarios that we go through, being one of the toughest challenges in the military intelligence. It's so tight, so close, so fast, that it's almost like a doomsday scenario put together for us. So I think any kind of diplomatic solution, not military, would always be the best solution.
So you came out of that training looking at the Strait of Hormuz scenarios thinking, what, this is going to be just a huge mess if it's military?
It is. Everything is just so fast and so quick. They have missiles right on you. They have air bases where they can have planes on you with just minutes. And exactly as he explained earlier, you really don't know your intentions until they're right on top of you.
Chris, I appreciate your call. Timothy Dury, what about Amy Jaffe said, well, yes, but look back to the Iraq-Iran war years. That's quite a while ago now in the 80s. And the U.S. escorting tankers through the Strait of Hormuz, and it worked out all right.
Well, I think things have changed significantly since then. You have to remember that Iran was locked in an 8-year ground war with Iran was locked in an 8-year ground war with Iran, and so most of their emphasis was on that conflict. They had inherited some naval capabilities from the Shah, which were really conventional naval capabilities. We did have an escort operation. One of our escort ships, the Roberts, hit a mine that turned out to be an Iranian mine. Before that, our special operations forces, especially Army Aviation, actually took out an Iranian mine layer, and it was captured. Mm. So some of these things worked out very well, but we also had a horrible incident because of this very short time between, you know, seeing a threat and actually responded to it,
yeah.
where we shot down an Iranian airliner,
yes.
the USS Vincennes,
yeah.
thought it was
yes.
under attack, mm-hmm. and it turned out to be an airliner taking off from Bandar Abbas going into, you know, somewhere in the Persian Gulf. And, you know, 290 Iranians were killed
yeah.
in that. Since this time, when the war, the Iran-Iraq war ended, the Iranians have really put a lot of emphasis on naval capabilities, what we call asymmetric naval capabilities, whereas they try to use certain capabilities against our strengths. And because of the geography and the very limited time, their capabilities have increased dramatically, even in the last 10 years. So I don't know if I would use the Iran-Iraq war period as the example of today. I think, you know, things have changed significantly since then.
Amy Myers Jaffe, it's kind of incredible that we're still so dependent on this narrow waterway. Are there other avenues to get oil out of the Persian Gulf? You know, if it should be closed, can we sort of divert the stuff into other pipelines? What would the effect be?
Well, we have some options. We did a big study here at Rice back in the 90s, and Saudi Arabia took some of that to heart. So Saudi Arabia does have a pipeline that goes from the eastern side of the country to the western side of the country. It can carry, 4 to 5 million barrels a day in an emergency. And then there's something called drag reduction agents. So I have this these chemicals. If I put them in a pipeline, mm-hmm. I can enhance the flow rate by, say, 50, 60%. So ironically, the Saudis might be able to get much of the oil that they export out through pipeline. The problem is that everybody else can't. So no natural gas in liquefied natural gas form from Qatar, no oil exports from Kuwait, Iraq, Iran. And that, you know, those
wow.
are substantial volumes.
Yeah, big volumes and not enough pipeline to take all that on board or just a way to get it there. Let's get a call here from Orlando, Florida. Arash, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Jess.
Hi.
I just want to quickly chime in on the Strait of Hormuz and give a little bit of a historical perspective on this. But, you know, back in 1988, there was an Iranian airliner with civilians that was shot down by U.S. naval forces.
Yes, we just heard that.
We didn't see any sort of, you know, pushback from Iran, you know, based on that notion. Your guest also mentioned earlier on that, you know, the Arab governments are in full support of, you know, any action that might be taken against Iran, but we're dismissing the fact that the Arab streets, their opinions are very, very different on, you know, on this issue. So who knows what type of effects we might have if there was an escalation, whether it was accidental, provocation, or whatever it might be. And also, you know, our Nobel Peace Prize-winning president, what all he's done to try and contain this issue is basically arm, you know, Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Pakistan and some of these countries that have been more hostile to the United States than Iran.
So, Arash, are you suggesting that it's the U.S. that's pushing things toward a crisis here? What about Iran's role?
I'm sorry?
Are you suggesting that it's U.S. pressure that's pushing things toward potentially a crisis here? And what about Iran's role, its nuclear program?
I mean, in a way, U.S. pressure did. I mean, isn't that what happened with the Japanese? When they attacked us on Pearl Harbor, there was a whole lot of things that happened before that. And one of the main things was the U.S. pressure on their economy, the effect that it started having on this society, it basically pushed them to the brink. Not to say that what they did was justified, but, I mean, there was a lot more historical precedence of that than just them attacking us and, you know, just for the heck of it.
Do you think that Iran is developing a nuclear weapons program, and should the U.S. stand by if it's doing that?
No, I don't think they're developing an actual program. I think they're just trying to develop the know-how. So if, in case they ever do need it, for whatever reason, if they are attacked, that they can't have a breakout strategy. So, you know, something similar to what other countries have adopted. I don't think they want to have to deal with, you know, the headaches of having a nuclear, you know, arsenal. Look at Pakistan. You know, that's a third world country that can barely afford to keep theirs going. So I think they see that and say, well, why would we want to have that threat? But, you know, it does work to our advantage just to have the know-how. So in case we ever do need it, you know, we can go ahead and resort to it if need be.
And the we you're using there is an Iranian we. If it should come to that, you're using an Iranian we. I understand there. Arash, I appreciate your perspective, a kind of a cool it, chill out to the U.S. message there. But let me get one more here from Saeed, Green Bay, Wisconsin. Saeed, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to put these provocations of Iran in proper perspective, because they are aimed purely for their domestic consumption. There is not only the maneuvers in the Straits of Hormuz, mm-hmm. but also an announcement that they are going to enrich uranium further in a deep underground laboratory,
yes.
and then the sentencing of an American citizen to death, despite the fact that over the weekend, as a humanitarian gesture, the American Navy rescued the 15 Iranian fishermen that had been taken hostage by the pirates in Somalia. So these provocations that the government of Iran is conducting are very calculated for their domestic consumption. The reason is that Iran's government faces a crisis of legitimacy right now. Parliamentary elections are underway, and the hypocrisy of the republic portion of the Islamic Republic is out in full display.
But Saeed, what about our caller Arash just before you, who has Iranian ties, says, look, this is, you're saying it's aimed at domestic politics. He's saying, U.S., don't put them in such a pressure cooker or you could create a crisis here.
The crisis they're facing is internal. It is a continuation of what happened in 2009. What the United States needs to realize is that they missed a historic opportunity in 2009. In standing with the Iranian people. It is important for Americans to understand that they have a partner for peace in the liberty-seeking Iranian opposition. They have no partner in peace in the tyrants that are running Iran right now.
Do you think it's all bluster, all just for show then, the talk of blocking the Strait of Hormuz and the rest, Saeed, if it's just for domestic consumption?
I believe it's a calculation on their part that that America, given its current state of affairs, given what's happened in Iraq, given what's happened in Afghanistan, given that we're in an election year, is not going to engage in military action, and they would even risk a military confrontation that was short of full occupation, and they know that that the United States is not in a position to have boots on the ground in Iran for an occupation that would lead to regime change.
That is interesting. Saeed, thanks for calling. Timothy Dury, what about it? Iran reading the U.S. is sort of tuckered out and overstretched between Iraq, where we're just out of, and Afghanistan and all the rest. Can you imagine them actually provoking some kind of military exchange, which they could picture as limited?
Well, I could see them doing something along those lines. Again, my biggest fear is miscalculation on their part. I don't think the U.S. is actually provoking them in any way, shape, or form.
Well, we're putting pressure on their central bank and its ability to finance oil sales, which are pretty important to their economy.
Correct. But as far as a military provocation, I don't really see that part of it. But again, if they ratchet up these exercises, especially when U.S. forces are in the vicinity, like I said, it's very difficult for a commander of a U.S. Navy ship to tell the difference between a mock attack and a real attack. They look almost the same.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, the commander would have the right to self-defense. So I think, again, the danger is of miscalculation. And for all the reasons the previous caller had, this could happen. And,
do you think the Stennis will come back? Iran said, don't come back, U.S. Stennis, the aircraft carrier, or we will, well, the threat was implicit, but I guess attack you.
It probably wouldn't be the Stennis. It'd probably be another aircraft carrier rotating through. And I think the U.S. would exercise its right to navigate an international waterway.
Pretty vulnerable moment when it's passing through the Strait of Hormuz.
But, again, it's showing that we're not going to be deterred from passing through international waters.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Iran, nuclear development, sanctions, threats, how they all come together in the Strait of Hormuz, choke point for one-fifth of the world's oil. Amy Myers Jaffe joins us from Houston. She's director of the Energy Forum at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy, author of Oil, Dollars, Debt, and Crisis, The Global Curse of Black Gold. Timothy Dury is with us from Monterey, California, in the Naval Postgraduate School there in Monterey, 28 years in naval intelligence and now a lecturer at the Naval Postgraduate School. And with us right now from Washington is Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council, author of the new book, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Trita Parsi, welcome back to One Point. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Help us understand the tension around the Strait of Hormuz and how it relates to the whole nuclear issue that is so much the focus of Washington thinking right now.
I've been very much enjoying what the previous guests have been saying, and I think the context through which we have to take a look at this is the fact, in the optimistic view sense, is that we are heading towards most likely another round of diplomatic talks between the United States, the P5+1, and Iran. And in the past, a pattern that we have seen is that prior to these talks, both sides try to maximize their leverage by taking new measures, such as imposing new sanctions on the Iranians, threatening an oil embargo, and on the Iranian side, of course, the various measures that they have taken, anything from, for instance, announcing today that they are starting enrichment at this new underground facility in Fordo that seems to be much more protected than any other facility that they have, which a lot of people, particularly in Israel, are worried will mean that this site essentially is untouchable and as a result may actually put under question the entire feasibility of a military attack.
So are you putting this in the bluffing? Are you in the this is bluffing camp then, Trita, or not?
It's not necessarily bluff, because bluff would mean that you are making a threat that you do not intend to utilize, but you're hoping that the other side believes that you are and that they will take measures according to that belief. This is more than a bluff, because this actually could happen. Some of the callers indicated that a lot of this has to do with internal politics. I think that's true to a certain extent. And that brings us to the more pessimistic interpretation, that even if the intent is to position ourselves for greater leverage at a negotiation, the question is, to what extent are we really in control of events? Could it be so that because of domestic pressures on either side, we may actually go a bit too far, and at some point we just lose control over the dynamics and we end up having to actualize threats that we actually didn't intend to actualize?
What U.S. domestic pressures are you referring to? We understand the elections coming up in Iran, but what about the U.S.?
Well, you know, the domestic pressures in the United States has been a key factor determining the Obama administration's Iran policy. So you had, for instance, just over the last couple of weeks, a situation in which Congress was putting pressure on the administration to impose new sanctions on Iran, central bank sanctions as well as oil sanctions. The administration actually objected to these sanctions and fought them. They came into the game a little bit too late, perhaps. But in spite of that, these sanctions passed with 100 votes to zero. Mm-hmm. That tells you something about the political landscape in Washington and the and its ability to constrain the Obama administration's maneuverability. And that's actually been a very critical factor, which I describe in detail in my book on why we have ended up here after what the Obama administration first tried to do, which was to negotiate with the Iranians.
The single roll of the dice you're talking about, as in your title.
Correct.
There. Let's go to Rohan in Hartford, Connecticut. Rohan, you're on the air with Amy Myers, Jaffe, Timothy Dury, and right here, Trita Parsi. Hi, Rohan.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to ask regarding to the Irani situation and their development of nuclear weapons as to whether or not America is going to go into possibly war with them as a result. And isn't it a little bit hypocrisy where other nations have been allowed to have nuclear development, and now that Iran is pursuing that, it seems as a little bit hypocritical on our part. I just want to know what is the comment on, or the answer towards that.
Trita, I'll come to you on that. I mean, Leon Panetta, we heard him there, but saying again over the weekend, nuclear weapons in Iran is a red line for the United States. Rohan is saying, well, we live with nuclear weapons in a lot of other countries. Given the stakes we're hearing here today, what about, is it worth it to put the red line here?
Well, I think there's two different issues here. One is talking about the Iranians having a nuclear weapon, and you can talk about it from the perspective of, is it legal and, you know, can we live with it? In the case of them actually building a nuclear weapon, it would be a violation of the non-proliferation treaty that they have signed.
But not the first time people have, you know, built nuclear weapons. I mean, I mean, sure, okay.
True, but, you know, most of the cases in which actually, if I'm not mistaken here, the only case in which a state actually has been a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and walked out of it and built a weapon is North Korea. Mm-hmm. The other cases we have are actually states that were never inside of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Israel, Pakistan, and India. The other nuclear-having states are states that were nuclear-having states at the time when the Non-Proliferation Treaty
was
created.
Seems like kind of a legalistic argument. Important, but nevertheless, legalistic.
I think it is very important because at the end of the day, if we're trying to resolve this issue and treat international law as if it doesn't exist, we're going to be in a much worse situation. And this is the other side of what Rohan said. Even though they are not entitled to a weapon as a signatory to the NPT, the NPT does provide them with the right to pursue peaceful nuclear technology. And the majority view in the international community is that that also includes nuclear enrichment. Previously, the Bush administration had taken a red line in which they said that enrichment is a red line, that they cannot do that. The Obama administration has had a much more ambiguous position here, not really making it clear. But what Panetta essentially has been saying, if I interpret it correctly, is that he's putting the red line at the weapon, not at the weapon capability, not at enrichment. And if that is a correct interpretation of what he's saying, that is actually quite an interesting development.
Amy Jaffe, what about in terms of the energy community? I mean, how close does Iran have to get to weaponry or enrichment before we get the sort of nuclear fear tax on oil transit that you were describing earlier?
Well, I think you have to separate two things. One is, are we going to have a regional conflict with Iran now because their government is going to miscalculate and maybe might even benefit from being bombed in a limited way? Maybe that would help their government out of their domestic problems. So that's problem number one. Anytime that sparks actually fly in the Middle East, the bomb gets released, something gets blown up, you know, that will at least temporarily be reflected in the price of oil. But to actually get, in my opinion, what I call the nuclear premium, you know, the Iranians would have to have capability, and that capability wouldn't just be that at some, you know, far-off depot they have a weaponized material. I mean, it would have to be, you know, they have a delivery system, because to make it a real threat that they're going to say the United States has to pull all its, you know, warships out of the Persian Gulf and can no longer protect the Arab flow of oil, you know, they'd have to have a real weapon that could be launched at American escorts, or launched at the Saudi oil fields or something like that. And I think they're farther away from that than just having one weapon. And also, it's going to depend on, you know, how well does the, you know, hedge fund community study strategic proliferation tactics, right? Are we going to say if they've got two warheads, because the United States can or Israel can come down with them with 100 warheads, that means they'd never use it? Or do we believe, watching Gaddafi and some of these other leaders in the Middle East, that these regimes, because they're so unstable, act irrationally? And that's to me, I'm more in that camp, that these regimes can act very irrationally, and we've seen it, you know, as recently as last year. And so I think it's a high risk that the Iranian regime could miscalculate, especially because they have dissent at the highest levels of their ranks. And so it's going to make decision-making even harder.
Trita Parsi, put that kind of speculation in the context of this strategic chessboard that we're looking here. Do you expect that it's ever going to happen or even get close to nuclear warheads being like up on top of missiles in Iran? Or do you expect some kind of intervention well before that ever becomes an event, you know, a reality? And if so, you know, what are the points at which that might happen?
I think that's a great question. Let me also just comment on what was said here earlier. I think it is absolutely correct to be concerned about a certain level of irrationality in a decision-making process that is clearly broken at times. And that is not just true in Iran, but it's also true elsewhere in the region. I would put Israel in that category as well. You have too many decisions that are geopolitical decisions being made on the basis of short-term, short-sighted, tactical, domestic considerations. That's very, very dangerous in a situation
like that. Up to and including the USA in that.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I think we should be very clear about that. We have problems on all sides. To add to that, what really makes this more complicated and more dangerous is that we have a huge deficit of diplomacy. And I think Mike Mullen, Admiral Mike Mullen, right before he left as the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, made this very clear in several interviews that he gave, in which he said that in the absence of communication between Iran and the United States, which essentially has been going on for about 30 years, we tend to misunderstand each other, misperceive, miscalculate. And when we don't have that communication and we miscalculate, we tend to escalate things. And when we escalate, things can get out of control. Combine all of these factors together and you see why I would personally tend to be more of the pessimistic view that even though some of this bluffing or blustering may not be intent on driving this towards a conflict, other circumstances, other structural factors can very well cause it to go in that direction anyways. On the issue of whether the Iranians would end up getting a nuclear weapon or whether we would act before, I certainly hope that we adopt a strategy that would be more effective than the current one that we have. I think that we have a mix of diplomacy and pressure that is too much tilted towards the pressure side. Essentially, pressure and sanctions are at the center of our policy, and diplomacy is somewhere in the margins. I think a reverse situation would be far more effective. And I'm fearing that the current policy, even though I do not believe that the Obama administration seeks a war and is very serious about trying to prevent the Iranian nuclear bomb, actually has a higher likelihood of getting into a situation in which Iran at the end of the day gets a bomb if we had a policy that was more centered on negotiations and trying to resolve this issue by really putting inspections, verification, intrusive inspections into the Iranian program at the center.
Of course, I mean, you well understand at the same time all the skepticism around that. That's been a long dance and not entirely successful. But bring the Israel
factor. It's not been a serious dance, I would say. It's been a long dance, but it's not been a fully serious dance. I think the Obama administration was very genuine.
Can I just add one element?
Yes, Amy?
Let me just add one element, what we haven't discussed. The issue of Syria is a critical piece of this whole chessboard. Iran has an effective means of extending its power in the region by being able to transfer weapons to Syria and having an alliance with Syria that affects Israel deeply through the arming of Hezbollah. And if, for some reason, through support from the Arab-Persian Gulf and U.S. diplomacy and U.S. pressure and Al Jazeera TV and so forth, the Syrian regime were to fall— and a regime that was anti-Iranian and not pro-Iranian would to come into place, it would greatly curtail the reach of the Iranian regime. So you have to look at the Syrian piece also as part of this puzzle.
Yeah.
And it makes it highly complex because we have a very aggressive policy in Syria, as do some of our allies in the region. And so I think the Iranians also, you know, need or do take that into consideration in thinking about the chessboard themselves. And then there's also the Kurdish unrest because, you know, the so-called nation of Kurdistan is not just these people who want to have independent part of a federation in Iraq, but they're active in Turkey and there's a big community also in Iran. And so there are a lot of moving pieces.
Trita, what about this thing we've heard most recently now, the Iranian enrichment moving deeper underground and making progress? How does that factor into a potential timetable of concern here? And give us the Israel factor.
I just came back from Israel and had some conversations with folks over there about this. This is what the Israelis call the zone of immunity, meaning that once the Iranians would have an operational plant in Fordo, in which they would be enriching uranium at the levels of around 19.75%, mindful of the fact that this facility is deep inside of the ground.
In the mountains, hard to get at.
Hard to get at. Mm-hmm. The Israelis described this, that once the Iranians do this, they're in a zone of immunity. Even if we were to take out other nuclear facilities, they would still have a well-protected nuclear program. And as a result, the military option essentially would become far less feasible than what the Israelis have deemed it to be up until this point.
What's the timetable on that? When do they get into that zone of immunity?
That's the interesting thing. The previous conversations have been that the Iranians essentially would make that site operational sometime within the next 3 to 6 months, perhaps. Now the Iranians have made announcement that they're already starting enrichment there. That may be a bluff. That may be a half bluff in the sense that they're starting something, but it's not fully operational. I would put that in the category of positioning themselves for this negotiation in February or late January, because I think one of the first demands, one of the first asks tasks of the United States in this negotiation mm-hmm. is going to be to ask the Iranians to cease those activities in Fordo or put it on some sort of a freeze. And the question is the U.S. willing to give Iran anything in return?
Here's a Facebook comment from Chad. When I was on the USS Boxer in 97, our ship passed through this Strait of Hormuz, and we immediately and automatically went to battle stations. To my understanding, Iran knew we were in the Gulf to perform Operation Desert Fox against Saddam, but the Iranians still decided to paint our ship, you know, radar paint, as we went through. The Strait has always been an area of anxiety for ocean-faring U.S. troops. Timothy Dury, we're certainly not solving this today, but I can only imagine that planning must be in high gear with all this flying around within the U.S. military right now.
I would think so, and I think it's an area that we've looked at for quite some time. I'm hoping that there is not a miscalculation on the part of the Iranians. You must remember that Iran has two militaries. It has the traditional, I'll use naval forces, it has the traditional navy, which is very professional, not as radical, and then it has the Revolutionary Guard Corps. And the Revolutionary Guard Corps has a separate chain of command going up to the Supreme Leader, and they tend to be much more aggressive. And I think if there was a miscalculation, it could probably be with the Revolutionary Guard Corps trying to either provoke the U.S. or you know, just ratchet up the tension a little bit. So I think that's the biggest concern I have is with the Revolutionary Guard Corps.
Let's hope that we get cool, wise heads on all sides in here, but there's clearly a risk that we will not. Timothy Dury at the Neville Postgraduate School in Monterey, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I should say there's a great slideshow at our website of all these features around the Strait of Hormuz. You should check it out from the Naval Postgraduate School. Amy Myers Jaffe at the Baker Institute for Public Policy, Rice University. Thank you so much, Amy, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Trita Parsi, author of the new book, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Thank you, Trita.
Thank you so much.
This is On Point.